need that today. Okay. So today is Hanukkah, the second day of Hanukkah, and it's our Sefer Chinuch class, December 10th, 2012. Last week we were looking at the mitzvah of Kiddush Shem Shemayim, sanctifying the name of Hashem. We did not finish it. We're probably not going to go in depth that. I wanted to make sure that we do a Hanukkah class today. But definitely connects, there's no question about it. Since Hanukkah was a time of Shmad, which we talked about last time a little bit, that there is a separate mitzvah. The mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem is different during a time of destruction than it is during regular times. Right, so last week we talked about how there are three major averas that we can't transgress if we want, we can't transgress, we have to give up our lives instead of transgressing. However, in a time of destruction, it could be for anything. Right. So even if they'll tell you wear a different colored shoelace than is the Jewish custom, you have to be in public, you have to be in order to destroy you, then we have to be willing to give up our lives for that. Okay, so that's that. It's interesting that when we learn about Kiddush Hashem, we learn about giving up our lives as opposed to how we live our lives.
It is sort of
right? It's an interesting thing. So, but that's the definition of is how are you ready to give up your life. Now, this past Shabbos, I gave a shiur on souls, and before Shabbos, I made kasha varnishkas and lakshan kugel and Yerushalmi kugel, and it was only three of us home for Shabbos. I thought, okay, what is going on here?
Look at all this, a little much.
Look at all this comfort food I'm making full of carbs. Like, what am I doing here? So I realized, because I've been thinking about it, that this is all comfort food. You know, I'm still in my whatever, you know, sometimes happy, sometimes a little bit sad process. So it was definitely comfort foods. But I took comfort in the fact that my comfort foods were all Jewish. Yeah. You know, it was nice to see. Because sometimes, you know, I wonder sometimes, like, about developing identity and all that stuff. But, like, I'm looking at these three comfort foods. They're very Jewish foods. So when I gave my shiur, I spoke a little bit about developing Jewish identity. Because in talking about souls, I talked about how souls enter and how souls exit the body. And then also, right, and then also when somebody converts, how does the soul become Jewish and at what point? Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thought. So, yeah.
Well, along those lines, I have been told that people who convert actually always had a Jewish soul.
Well, so it depends. There's different.
And that is apparently what some people believe.
I think there are people whose souls were always Jewish, and they just have to make the transition. They were, for whatever reason, a tikkun, they were born, could be a reincarnation, they were born into a non-Jewish body, and they somehow have to return their soul back to the Jewish people. But there's also, along with that, and also true, there are souls that were present in the other nations when God offered the Torah to the other nations and said, do you want the Torah? And we know that Midrash, right, where the other nations said, oh, what's in it? Stealing, oh, we're not interested. Oh, what's in it? You know, no murder, oh, we're not interested. What's in it? No. Sexually, we're not interested. Right, but there were, so that was the malach of the nation that said we're not interested, but there were some individuals in those nations who said we do want it. So they received it when Hashem offered it.
Oh, okay.
But they weren't Jewish. So they had to go through the generations to join their souls. So that's another.
A way to look at it.
That's another. That's a second.
Oh, it's a different second
set of converts.
Okay.
And
how
do
you know which part you belong to?
You don't necessarily.
I just wondered.
You don't necessarily. Anyway, so it's interesting. I spoke to another woman who converted after the class, and she said that for her, she always wondered, like, in terms of giving up her life, al Kiddush Hashem, like, when does somebody get to that point? And she has measured her Jewish identity by that, by could she, would she. And I thought that's an interesting thing, because that's not at all how I'd rather measure my Jewish identity by Yerushalmi Kugel, by how I live, for sure. So who I identify with, the jokes I tell, the humor that tickles me, whatever it is, there's so many different ways to measure Jewish identity. But I found it fascinating that she measured hers that way. So in looking at that, let's...
That even.
Right? It's interesting
to
think about.
Well, that was part of my process.
Really? See, I never, ever, ever thought about it.
I had to be able to answer that
question about what you would,
would I hold on to my life and say, somebody had a gun to my head and said, you're a Jew, and I'm going to kill you because you're a Jew.
Would I say, wait a minute,
I was born Christian, you know, or would I just be silent and do what needs to be done? We had a discussion on Shabbat at Mashori that you might be able to say, wait a minute, to save your life at that moment really depends.
Uh-huh, right.
That wasn't in my mind. I had to be able to say, I would stand with the Jews of this world no matter what.
See, and I guess that is a difference because
if
you're born Jewish, there's no question. I mean, you know, if you're Jewish, you're Jewish.
Right.
So if they line you up and say you're Jewish, you're not. You don't have the option of saying, just kidding.
Right.
I guess there have been some who have denied it
in order
to save their lives.
Well, yeah, but I'm just, I mean...
But it's a fascinating thing. And in fact, today the halacha, when I first started learning with somebody who's in the conversion process, so I was told, I wasn't sure, like how, because there's a shaila, are you allowed to teach Torah Shebaal Peh to a non-Jew? The answer is no, you're not allowed to teach Torah Shebaal Peh, oral law, to a non-Jew, unless they're in the conversion process. So at And what about the turning away of a prospective convert three times? How does that work? Is that halacha? How does that work? So I was told that what you have to do is sit that prospective convert down and tell them, if you convert to Judaism, you're going to be subject to death in ways that you're not if you're non-Jewish.
Hello.
Welcome.
Right? Way number one that you'll be subject to death is you'll be subject to the death penalty for violations of Shabbos. That you would not be subject to. So as a Gentile, you can turn a light on and off all day long on Saturday and no problem for you. But as a Jew, big problem, so are you sure you want to jump into that? And number two, you'll be subject to anti-Semitism. And you, not just you, your children, all your descendants could be killed for you making this decision. Are you willing to take that on? So once the person would answer yes, they're willing to be subject to death in two different ways, then you're allowed to learn with them, and then they could, then that shows that they're enough headed towards conversion that you can also learn oral law with them for the sake of their conversion. That's what I learned anyway.
But now so much of the oral law is available outside of Jewish teaching.
Right.
Because we started on it before we started.
Right, but that's not, the question isn't, and there's a separate question for the Gentile, are they permitted to learn the oral law? That's a separate question from, is a Jewish person permitted to teach it? Right. Right, so that was that question. We're doing a Hanukkah class today.
But we haven't quite started.
But we're segueing in. Okay, so we're talking about Kiddush Hashem. Okay, so now let's look. I want to look at a few things about Hanukkah and a few things about Kiddush Hashem that have to do with Hanukkah. And I want to start with Rav Hirsch. So that's the back of the page of Preserving the Memory of a Victory. So just two little things. One part I copied specifically for Laura, but for everybody.
So good thing you're here.
Yeah, it is. So two things here that I just want to point out from the sources here. So oil is often referred to as wisdom, or it's parallel to wisdom in Jewish thought. So the question is, where do we see that? We hear that, where do we see that? I'm sure there's other places where we see that, but I just brought the Rav Hirsch here so you could hear. It's not my idea. It's not an H.com idea. It comes from deeper places. Rav Hirsch is certainly quoting deeper places, too. But the fact that oil represents wisdom in Jewish thought. So in that case, so here we have on verse 20 of chapter 27 of Exodus, of Shmot, Rav Hirsch's commentary, he's talking about the Ketoret, the spice offering, and the candles. Let's see, but I'll just read, starting from the middle of the paragraph, pretty much right in the middle, where it says, by bringing the service of the lights here, immediately following the orders for building the sanctuary, and even preceding instructions for the priestly garments, two things are indicated. On the one hand, the service of the lights, avodat ha-nerot, the care of the lights, is the duty, which in point of time takes precedence over all other duties, as the clearness of mental vision, which is to be derived from the Torah, is the mother of keeping the dictates of the Torah. Gadol Talmud Shemivi Lidei Maaseh. Greater is learning that brings to doing. So you have to have clarity of understanding before you can do anything. And on the other hand, that the essential mission of the Kohen is nurturing the enlightenment that is to be derived from the Torah. So let's see if we need that sentence. Okay. These points are necessary for the understanding of the meaning of the priestly garments and instructions for making of which immediately follow. Okay, so we're going to see that. So, but here it's talking about how the actual oil, the service of the lights and the oil itself represents wisdom. So, and that's what, I think it says that up here higher too, clarity, representing clarity of the mind. Anyway, so clarity of the mind. That's what the oil represents, is clarity of the mind. Mm. So it's just fascinating to look at the Hanukkah story with that in mind, that as we sought out that last, as we were re-sanctifying the temple, and we have to leave behind the childish notions that they made a mess of the temple. They didn't make a mess of it. I just like to remind everybody every year. It's not like the Greeks went in and destroyed things and people had to go in and clean it up. That wasn't the case. The Greeks were all about beauty. And they loved intellectual beauty and philosophy. They certainly weren't going to go in and destroy what was a beautiful building and a beautiful ritual.
Who slaughtered pigs then on the altar?
Slaughtering pigs. We slaughtered all kinds of animals on the altar. Just because they slaughtered a pig doesn't mean they destroyed.
They destroyed the kedusha.
But they didn't, like, as when we talk to children, or when we learned it as children, or just learn it younger, or you learn it cursorily, so you just think about them making a whole big mess. They went in, there were soldiers, they were burly, they hit things, they knocked things down, they made a mess, and we had to go in and clean it up.
It wasn't that kind of cleaning at all.
Okay.
So we Jews love the intellect, right? Woody Allen says his brain is second favorite organ.
Yeah.
We love our brains.
Right.
So we're all about that, which is why we wear a yarmulke on top of our brains as Jews to remind us, or if we're married, so we wear another head covering to tie into our husband's wisdom. But whatever, as a concept, as a Jew, we wear a yarmulke to show us that there's something above and beyond our intellect. We think our intellect is the tops. It's not. There's something that we can't understand, and we wear that to say we have the fear of heaven above us. And our intellect is not the tip top of everything, although we easily get caught into that. So, but we love intellect. So the Greeks were all about intellect and beauty of thought. And the Talmud even says that Greek is the most beautiful of languages. So I think that's a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like the sound is when I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know enough about Greek language to know if it's beautiful. I love Hebrew and I love all the connections in Hebrew. To me, that's beautiful. But I'll trust them when they say, because they know, they knew both languages, that Greek is a beautiful language. But it's not just about the Greek, it's about what it expresses and what they were. So the Jews were very taken after the Hellenistic culture. They loved it. As opposed to, let's say, when we were in the Persian exile. We were not attracted at all to Persian culture. And the Talmud discusses the Persians, it calls them hairy bears. They were seen, really, they were seen as boors, right? And but the Greeks were seen as intellectual, it was beauty. And it was the kind of beauty that we love. It wasn't
intellectual beauty.
It wasn't just the physical beauty, which they also had.
Yeah.
They were also into that, but they the intellectual beauty, the beauty of philosophy, of poetry, of literature, of architecture, of mathematics, they knew from beauty.
Their minds were very ordered.
Yeah, and we were all about it, which is why this exile is an exile of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only exile that we experienced in our land with our temple standing. Right? So the exile was an intellectual exile. So is Hishchichu Einei Yisrael, right? They darkened the eyes of the Jews. So and when we look in the second pasuk in the Torah where it says Va'aretz hayta tova v'choshech al pnei hatahom, right? So those words refer to the four exiles. The world was null and void and darkness was on the face of the deep. So null, void, darkness, deep refer to the four exiles. So null is Babylonian, and void is Persian, darkness is Greek, and deep is the one that we're in now, so long, we can't even see the bottom of it, that's the deep exile. But darkness is the Greek one. So darkness, it's the only exile where we are in our land with our temple. It's an intellectual exile. So that's this exile is a special one because we got so confused. What actually is beautiful was our question. And we lost track of what we offer to the world in our own special, what we carry into the world. So that losing track was the losing track of the oil. We lost track of our special intellect and the purity of it, which is why when we sought to relight the menorah, what we looked for was pure oil. We didn't need it halachically. We just fought a war. There wasn't much pure oil, right? Everybody was tamei mate, which we've learned about before. So everybody had, there were 7 days they had to wait until they could do what they had to do in order to produce oil that wouldn't have that tuma, so they could light it with non-tamei oil. However, halachically in that case, after a war, when everybody's tamei mate, no problem, they could have lit it with whatever oil they had. But the whole point of Hanukkah was not the rededication of the temple, but the rededication of who we are as Jews and what we offer to the world. And that's why it was vital to look for the pure oil, the pure Jewish intellect, untainted Jewish intellect among the ruins of our mixing with the Greeks. We had to find that which is uniquely Jewish and untainted by any outside forces. And that's the light that we shed into the world. That's what Hanukkah is about, is bringing that light into the world. That's what learning Torah is about. So here's the part for Laura and everybody else.
Where was your special part?
I'm like, well, is it because I remember, and I don't remember if I've discussed this with you, but learning from a non-Jewish scholar at DU, I taught a religion class, and he talked about the fact that that whole idea of desecrating the temple, and he said, and that's the first time I had heard it, was from him, and I didn't know if that was what you were saying, or if it was like beauty, because like Your work is beauty, right, for sure.
Nope, here's the part for you.
Beauty.
Next page, right? Okay, so the two-thirds are about three-fifths down the page where it says, La'alot ner. So this is referring to the pasuk. So let's just read the pasuk in English here, the verse 20. And thou shalt command the children of Israel that they take for thee pure olive oil pressed for lighting to make a light shine out continuously. Okay, so in Hebrew, v'atat tzaveh et b'nei Yisrael v'ikhu alecha shemen zayit zach katit l'ma'or l'ha'alot ner tamid. Okay? So we just discussed shemen zayit zach, pure olive oil, the pure Jewish intellect that represents. But now we're going to discuss the words l'ha'alot ner. When we make a bracha on lighting the candles, what do we say? L'ha'alot ner, asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu l'ha'alot ner? No, lahadlik ner, right?
Lahadlik.
Lahadlik is the verb that's used to light a candle, but that's not the one that's used here. It's lahalot ner. So it's a very strange grammatical usage. What are we doing talking about lahalot ner here? So this is such an important paragraph and should be cut out and framed by everybody who's into education. Lahalot ner. This expression for kindling lights occurs only with reference to the service of the menorah. It is the precise description of the demand to keep the kindling flame against the wick until the latter burns by itself. The work of a Torah teacher is to make himself superfluous, not to keep the laity in lasting dependence on teacher or priest. At the same time, it is an admonition to enduring patience for teacher and pupil. So two principles are taught here. One is the necessity for patience of the teacher to keep that flame there until the wick lights itself.
And it's funny and that then, you do that without even thinking about
and
it.
And then pull away. Right? It's not the job. So this is really contrasting to Christian priests, right, who want to keep their laity dependent on them for interpretation. And many, there have been mistakes made throughout Jewish history where Jews have slipped into that as well. So what he's reminding us is that we're not to make our students dependent on us, but rather to make them independent. We want to give them the tools to learn on their own and then say, go. Of course, we have a Masorah, and of course, that needs to be transmitted. But we want to make students independent and give them the tools that they need to be independent in their own learning and spiritual growth. So that's what this is about. When we're talking about using that pure Jewish wisdom to light up the world, the way that it should be used is l'ha'alot ner, to rise up a flame. Not to light, but to cause it to rise up. That each one of us is our own individual wick, and each one of us can channel that Jewish wisdom in the world and enlighten the world with it. We just need the patience of a teacher to give us some time and then pull back, because we can shine on our own. So that's what
that's
this
such
is.
A cool
Isn't that so
concept.
Nice?
That is so cool. I really like that.
Makes me think of the old expression that if you feed a man, if you feed him for a day, but if you teach him how to fish,
the whole idea behind the Hipper International.
Right. So that's what this is.
So the originally, this quote is from where?
That's from Shemot, from Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
From Exodus chapter 27. Verse 20, you just have to write that at the top of your page, because sadly this book is not, it's translated, but not translated well enough that it's easy for somebody who doesn't read Hebrew to find anything. So Shemot is Exodus, it says
at the top,
and 27.
And even
so it's Exodus 27.
Isn't that good?
Even the new one, they didn't. They
got the whole new one where
they failed to make it accessible.
It translates more of the Hebrew in his comments. Yes and no.
It translates it more idiomatically
yeah.
fresh for
yeah.
today.
Right.
I happen to
really
like the old English of her
yeah.
first.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
It didn't do what I
so
did.
This comes from Torah?
It is.
This is Rav Hirsch's commentary. Shem Shemrafel Hirsch's
commentary
on that
says.
Verse.
So the commentary
this
it
verse
says.
Is in Torah.
This
right.
verse is in Torah. Laha Alot Ner. That's verse 20.
Well, I'll tell you why this is really interesting. Because I had this conversation several times over the weekend, over Shabbat, wondering, do we have, we talk about as a mitzvah of lighting the candles. Well, we use mitzvah for lots of things.
Right.
So it's a mitzvah, take out the garbage, right?
Right. Smart.
Turn everything into something real.
Totally. Right. I used to have a mitzvah tree in the basement. I'd give my kid leaves on it for all kinds of things. Like, who wants a leaf on the mitzvah tree? Right. They did all kinds of things for a leaf. Amazing.
And so my question was, is it a mitzvah, deraita, or, and if it is, or if it's not, are we supposed to be making a bracha?
On a candle.
On a candle, so where does this all come from? And I did not get from.
Oh, okay, hang on.
Right,
so hang on.
Different.
This is the menorah,
yeah.
not the Hanukkah.
Yeah, this is different. This is not for
this
Hanukkah.
Is the menorah. So it's fascinating to see that we have all kinds of hints in the Torah. But the holiday of Hanukkah was established
right, yeah.
in the end of the Second Temple period.
Right.
So well after the Torah was sealed, canonized
right.
and sealed, right?
Yeah.
So you have the five books done,
right.
all the prophets are done.
Right.
And actually the book of Maccabees, which is the story of Hanukkah recorded, was rejected from the canon, not seeing as being prophetic. It's a story, but not seeing as prophecy, so it's not included in the 24 books of the Torah. So it's not there. However, we learn things from that verse, and we see hints to Hanukkah throughout the Torah. So some of the hints include that the Hanukkah is on the 25th day of Kislev, right, of this
mm-hmm.
month. So the 25th word in the Torah is light. Okay, that's hint number one. In the 40 stops, yeah?
We were talking about it years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it. It was, and I forgot which book it is of the Torah, when where it lists all the holidays.
Yes. That's a very strong hint. Yes.
Logical order.
Yes.
Then there is a paragraph about lighting the menorah.
Yes. Exactly. So that's the other hint. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the weaker hints are the 25th word of the Torah is or, is light. The 25th of the 40 stops that we had in the desert, the 25th
mm-hmm.
stop was at Hashmonaim. And you're exactly right, Anna. The strong hint is where it lists all the holidays, I believe in Parshas Pinchas, it lists all the holidays, and it does a review of all of them, and then after it finishes with Shmini Atzeret, the last holiday that there is, the very next verse is about kindling the lights of the menorah. So it's a hint, you know?
It
so like,
say,
here you
yeah.
have all the holidays, and then you have the service of the menorah right after it.
Okay, so this
so it's
is
like,
about the menorah.
Right.
Yes.
So I was like, wait a minute,
correct.
How did nobody know that?
Correct.
It's not,
now, that being said, answering your question about how do we make a bracha is that our sages are empowered with that.
Right.
So it's not deraisa, it's derabanan.
Yes.
But they are allowed to say,
asher
kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. It's a mitzvah to light them. And they were empowered with creating that mitzvah and certain mitzvot, lighting Shabbos candles also. They're empowered with making that bracha, creating that bracha for us to say, Asher kedishanu b'mitzvotav vitzivanu, and commanded us to, so that we definitely have sagacious interaction with the Torah law. Okay.
Thanks.
Sure. Okay, checking the time here. Okay, where do we want to go first? There's such juicy stuff that we have. Okay.
Well, what was the deal with the tense of, was it the tense of this word, the
not in the tense, the actual verb, lahalot, means to raise up from aliyah, or aliyah, aliyah to the Torah, or aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, right? Lahalot is to go up, lahalot to cause, to raise up, as opposed to lehadlik, to light, to kindle,
okay.
Right? So it's actually...
Different
word.
Different
word. Completely
different
word, and is not a word we use for lighting candles.
Ever.
As light.
Yeah, ever.
Right, right. We never use this word. It's only here by this service. So he translates it, because the translation is idiomatic, so that you should understand,
right.
Translated as lighting.
But
what
really
is that? How would you translate
word.
It to raise up a light?
Like,
that doesn't
right.
make any sense at all.
Right.
But the commentary has to address it, because it's a strange usage of the
yes,
word.
That is what we do. when you light a light using another candle, that is exactly physically what you do.
Right, raising it up, you're saying.
Yeah.
To put,
you put it there and you let it there and then you watch.
Until it raises up.
Until it goes up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. Okay. Let's,
And when the kids light the Shabbos lights, I teach them to do that.
What was there was not a Shemesh
No, you had to use something else. So it's just the menorah, not the Chanukiah.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we have a shamash on the Chanukiah is because we're not permitted to use the lights of the menorah for anything. So we can't use them. Let's say one light blows out.
To light each other.
Let's say one light blows out. You can't just take a match and stick it in one of the Hanukkah lights to relight that other Hanukkah light. Okay, let's say, so, correct, you cannot do that. Let's say it's dark.
You can use the shamash again.
You can use the shamash again, no problem. Let's say it's dark. Right? And it's in the olden days. You don't have electricity. And now you have these candles burning. You want to
read
something.
Yeah.
You can't read by them. You can't use that light. So we have a shamash to protect us from, by mistake, using the light of the candles for seeing or reading or to rekindle something. So that's what we have the shamash for. It's not that you have to use a shamash to light them. You have to use something to light them. But and
so
you don't have
to
have a shamash. So that's just a protection so you won't come to use the lights of the Chanukiah for anything else.
So could you use a different, could you have a Chanukiah that didn't have a shamash?
Yeah.
You could,
yeah, there are a Chanukiah
yeah,
without
okay.
a shamash.
I mean, I
yeah.
just...
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to make
have
sure
something
that
else you use to light it.
Device you use
right.
to
and
light
a Chanukiah is 8.
It's separate from
something
that.
Else too,
yeah.
Right?
Right. A Chanukiah is 8 and a menorah is 7. So that's how you can
right.
tell the difference between
right.
the two.
Right.
Usually a Chanukiah is 9 because of the shamash.
Right.
So, but really a Chanukiah is 8 and a menorah
right.
is 7.
Right. So, but it's an odd number of branches in the menorah, but the central one is just as equal as the others, right?
No, because the central one in the
menorah.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, I did not fully learn this. I'll just throw it out there for your wondering, because it's this week, right? So Parshas Miketz. Is it this week when Pharaoh has his dreams, right? So I heard from Esther Wien, and I did not go into the study, I didn't look it up, but I thought it was fascinating, and I think the idea comes from Rabbi Debbie Foreman, that the two dreams are Hanukkah dreams, right? So that we have these, we have this concept of Hanukkah, of the few overcoming the many, the weak overcoming the strong, right? So the first dream is the skinny cows overcoming the fat cows, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have the weak overcoming the strong and the healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Hanukkah theme number one in the first
yeah.
dream. And the second dream is 7 sheaves on one stalk.
Hmm.
That's a menorah, right?
Oh,
so that's all I could say about it because that's all I learned. But
okay.
I thought that was fascinating and bears
yeah.
looking into it. Like,
yeah.
how are these dreams Hanukkah dreams? I never heard that before. And I never, so I just think it's fascinating thing to look into.
Hanukkah.
Right, right. So, but it's always the parsha. It's Miketz is Shabbat Hanukkah.
So, how weird.
Oh, that's going to hit number 4, right? Right, so there's interesting stuff all around. The more you learn, the more interesting it gets. Okay, let's see. I guess let's do this one first because it's short, and then hopefully we'll get to the second one. Okay, so why do we celebrate Hanukkah when it was not a long-term victory? The Hasmoneans, the Hashmonaim, so I'm on preserving a memory of a victory. So after they won the war, the next generation, the generation after that, blew it already. They were already back into the corrupt power, and things were not good in Israel at the time, and among the Jews. The Jews were misbehaving. And the Hasmoneans, that family, misbehaved as well. So, but the generation that did Hanukkah were behaving correctly. So we did set a holiday for that time, but a question is, why? It was a short-lived victory. So this is not an eternal thing. So what about it was eternal? We have to ask that, because none of our holidays are historical reminiscences of things that happened. That's not what our holidays are about. Our holidays are about permanent energy oases in the calendar. How do they create that is the question. What was created here that it bears remembering for generations? What happened here, and what can we access? So so let's just look at what Rav Dessler has to say. This is translated by his student,
Carmel.
Thank you, Arya Carmel. Right, Arya Carmel. Okay, so the Hasmoneans, by their self-sacrifice, demonstrated that inner light of Torah can never be extinguished. This holds true for all times. Each generation of exile presents a dark night specific to itself, and Torah prevails over them all. This is symbolized by the miracle of the oil, which continued to burn for 8 days. The rabbis chose this to symbolize the victory of Hanukkah because they wanted us to reflect on the eternal significance of the miracle. Is this where it goes into the number 8? Or is it the other one? Okay, so we'll just leave that paragraph and you can read the rest, but I'll tell you. So 8 days. Hanukkah is 8 days long, so we talked about how the oil, right, is the central thing here. It's the Jewish wisdom that we're trying to get, but also this concept that every single generation that we go through presents its own darkness, and it's our job to enlighten it. Rabbi Kahan taught several years ago, it's just something I hadn't reflected on until he said it, that the God-made holidays are during the times of light, and the human-made holidays are during the times of darkness. Mm-hmm. So God-made holidays are from Pesach to Shmini Atzeret, right? So from spring to from the beginning of the light period of the year till the end of the light period of the year. That's when Hashem made the holidays, right? And then we have this dark period. So that's the period for our response, really, in the nighttime. Who will provide light there? And that's up to us. It's our job to bring light into the darkness. It's our job to be an Or LaGoyim. It's our job to shed the light of the Torah. Hashem gave us the Torah. It's our job to shed it. Right?
So why can't we have those pretty little lights?
Yeah, right.
We're supposed to be those pretty little lights all over.
You can put tinsel or something on your
side. That's the whole trick. That's what Uri asked me 1 second since he was little. He said, Emo, why do people put sukkah lights on their trees? So in your sukkah, you could decorate it very pretty. But but that's the thing, is that we're supposed to not just put the lights on the outside, but we're actually supposed
light.
To be those lights. That's our job, is to be those lights. So we said that the oil is the thing that we use to commemorate this holiday because it has to do with seeking out that pure Jewish intellect. In every generation, we can get swayed, we can get lost in the Gentile thoughts around us, whatever they are, the thoughts of our host cultures, some of which go with our thoughts and some of which do not, many of which do not. But it's our job to constantly seek out what's pure and shed that light. But then also, if you take the 8 days of Hanukkah and realize that it's 8, and there's all kinds of questions, there's a whole long thing, which I'm not going to go into, why is it 8 days? Really, the miracle is only 7 days, you know, because if they had enough oil for 1 day, so then that's not a miraculous day, right? It's only miraculous on the other 7. Why shouldn't it be 7 days? So there's all kinds of answers to that. Classic Hanukkah question, lots
Jewish
of answers. We're not going to go into those. What I do want to go into is they just chose 8. They chose 8 because 8 is the realm of the soul. You say 8 in Hebrew, Shmoneh. Right, and you rearrange those letters and you get neshama. So 6 is the realm of natural things, thinking about a cube, it has 6 sides, held together with the inner dimension, which is Shabbos. So even the seventh realm is still part of nature, because that's the glue that holds everything together, the raison d'etre, the purpose of everything is that seventh level, Shabbos, that brings it all together. So that's a cube and its inner space. And above and beyond that is the realm of 8, the realm of soul, neshama, right? And that's why we circumcise on the 8th day, because we're going into beyond what's natural, into the realm of the supernatural, into the realm of the soul. So, and that's why this holiday is 8 days long, because this has to do with the supernatural. It does not have to do with what's in nature. It has to do with us. If we went according to nature, we wouldn't be here anymore. We wouldn't be able to access what's purely Jewish about us, and we wouldn't even physically exist, let alone intellectually exist. And we do intellectually exist. We have our pure, untainted Jewish wisdom that's still here, that we still bring forward in every generation. And it's a total miracle. It has nothing to do with nature. And it couldn't have to do with nature, because of what we've been through, it's not possible. So that's what brings us to boldness in the cause of holiness. So this is, in Hebrew, this is called Azus Dikdusha, Azut Dikdusha. Azut is chutzpah. It's another word for chutzpah. So you'll hear that word, azut, in the word Boaz, right? The husband of Naomi, right? His name is Boaz. In him is chutzpah. He had to be a very chutzpahic guy to marry this Moabite woman when it was just clarified as halacha that you were permitted to convert as a Moabitess but not as a Moabite, right? So he had some very strong chutzpah to say, I clarify this halacha, it's completely acceptable, so acceptable that I myself, the sage of the generation, will marry her. That's how much chutzpah I have. But not, so his name is not Chutzpan, it's Boaz, in him is Az. So we have this concept of Azut Dikdusha, holy chutzpah, right? And that's, we need that as a nation. We have to be a chutzpahic people Because without the chutzpah, we'd never get anywhere. We have to have the chutzpah. The chutzpah can go in either way, right? And mm-hmm. does go in negative ways mm-hmm. also. However, without it, we'd never be able to survive. So it's a principal quality of the Jew, is this concept of chutzpah. So this article looks at Azut Dikdusha, the chutzpah, holy chutzpah.
Ayin.
Okay, so the flask of oil lasted for 8 days. So we talked about eight. So here's an interesting concept. So it talks about Olam Haba is not discussed in the Torah, because the Torah was given through Nevuah. Nevuah, prophecy, there's two different ways of understanding our Jewish concepts. One is through Nevuah and one is through our intellect. Nevuah can only be given through the senses. So it can only reveal things that the senses could appreciate. Even if it reveals it enigmatically, it has to be something that the senses can grasp. So Olam Haba is not something the senses can grasp at all, so we don't see it discussed in the Torah at all. However, we do see it discussed in the oral law, which is Chacham, right? Comes through the intellect. Chacham, we have a phrase that says, Chacham Adif Mi Navi. That's the end of the second paragraph here. Chacham, you can just see the words here. Chacham Adif Mi Navi. The sage is greater than the prophet. So that's a principle that the Talmud lays out here in Bava Batra 12a, which I did not look up and should have, but in the actual context of it. But we do have this principle that Chacham Adif Mi Navi. So why is that? We do believe that grappling with the concepts ourselves instead of having them handed to us on a silver platter is the better way to get the information. Nevuah is handed, even though a Navi has to cultivate himself or herself and work very hard to become a kli, to become a vessel for receiving Nevuah. Still, the Nevuah, once the person has cultivated themselves, the Nevuah is handed to them, as opposed to achieving it through the intellect, which is a constant grappling, a constant working, a constant sharpening of the intellect and with others to get to a place where you understand something that you can't necessarily always get to through your other senses. So in Olam Haba could be understood through the intellect, not understood, but at least discussed, right? You can go from allegory to kind of try to get to something that will help you understand the concept in Olam Haba, which you can't get to through Nevuah.
Isn't that all? It doesn't say the sage is greater than what? Just the sage is greater.
Than the prophet.
Than the prophet.
Greater.
Yes.
It's just an interesting concept.
Chacham Adif, preferable.
Yeah.
Not even great. It's not even greater. It's preferable. Yeah, preferable. Adif.
Right.
Adif is preferable.
It makes sense what you're saying. So no, but a Navi has to retain a certain level of midot, I would say.
Yeah.
Like a certain level of character. So it's a lot easier to just run at the mouth, for instance, and speak lashon hara.
I hear what you're saying, and still work on your intellect.
Yeah, like you could still be like really
I don't think you could be a real chacham. I mean, there are people who have achieved intellectual heights, but they're not a real chacham if they don't have the midot also to hold
it.
They
have to have wisdom. Yeah. I mean, that's basically wisdom.
I mean, you know, there are, and you can see that in people who have achieved a lot of knowledge, whether they have a high degree, you know, whether they have a PhD in something and they're really, who are they? Or whether they're what some people might call a Talmid chacham just because they've achieved a lot of Jewish learning, but they're not a mensch.
Right.
You know, so that's not a real Talmud Chacham.
Right. And
it's
the other
not.
Thing is, I guess in our day, we don't really know.
No.
We don't. It's not really a way
in. We do know that there are not Nevi'im.
Right.
And let me just, you had a quick question, which I'll just.
No, it's
okay. Navi is a prophet. Nevuah is prophecy. Nevuah is prophecy, and Navi is a prophet, male prophet. Nevi'ah is a female prophet. Nevi'im is plural. Right. This is from this one, Rav Dessler's Strive for Truth, Volume 4. I meant to write that on there. Volume 4. So I did write it on our sheets here, so just so you could see. Rav Dessler's Strive for Truth,
right.
Volume 4, pages
right.
151 to 155.
Right.
And 158, that's what I copied for you.
Well, and one of the reasons that I would think that, there are many reasons, that to study Gemara really trains your mind to think in a deeper way, a more examining way. You're
right.
Not just mouthing what Hashem told you to say. Hashem told me this is the way it is, which is what a prophet
right.
would do, versus a chacham who is able to work through
right.
all the gifts that Hashem has given us.
Well, that's why we still learn Gemara today.
Right. right.
Learning
that's
Gemara
I mean.
Is about developing that, because
yeah.
it's not about getting the information. If it was about
no.
getting the information, you just
no.
open a book and read it.
The mind.
Right. We have plenty of stuff. Right. We
right.
have plenty of stuff that just says, here's the halacha.
Right.
right. So if you want to know Shabbos Kitchen, you just open the book and it says
right.
you could do this, you can't do that.
Right.
But that doesn't develop your, that gives you the information. That's a separate piece. Learning Gemara is about developing, it's about connecting with Hashem in that intellectual process, trying to create that.
I think this society has lost that ability. We are just kind of mimicking what we learn in a class.
Very often.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know when I try to explain to my son what is being really done in these yeshivas, it's far more than information. They're not memorizing information.
Right.
They are teaching their minds how to think.
Right.
And that's what the world has lost. Because if you don't write like your professor wants you to write in a class, so you just kind of learn to mimic
yes.
what's being taught to you, you're not taught to think through a process, because you can be harmed
mm-hmm.
or damaged or flunk.
Right. Right. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Don't say anything pro-Israel in a class. That can cause 2 points also.
Yeah.
It's a real problem today.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
I mean, since you have a boy in university.
And a girl.
And a girl,
yeah.
that's right. That's
yeah.
a girl. Well, yeah, another boy.
Pro-Israel.
Oh, yeah. Pro-Israel.
It's very risky today.
Yeah.
Very risky to come to defense of Israel today. Yeah.
Sorry for the interjection.
Okay.
Just made me think about that.
I had the same thought.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. To, and it's possible to engage in yeshiva learning without getting there. We see
okay,
that, too,
yeah, that's, I'm
unfortunately.
Sure. I'm sure it is.
Right. But the concept is to get there, is to get to that. That's why it's la'asok b'divrei Torah, to engage in the words of Torah. It's not to memorize the Torah, and it's not to just get all the information. That's not the bracha. The bracha is la'asok, to engage in, to be involved in, to mix it into your life, to make it sweet by the mixing. It's interesting that when we say that bracha in the morning, the ha'erevna, please mix these words into my life or sweeten these words, the words for mix and sweeten is the same word,
mm.
right? It's sweetened by the mixing, by it becoming part of you. It becomes so sweet and delicious.
Okay.
Like, but it only if it's part of you, not just that you're, you know, saying it over.
Regurgitating.
Right, right. It has to be part of you.
I do that one in English, so I don't.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them I do in Hebrew, but that
right.
one I do in English, so I didn't.
So maybe
that.
You should learn it, yeah. So, and there's always another level to learn, you know. Yeah, I have to. I'll just say thank you to Terry Samuel and to Rabbi Unger also, because, I mean, I used to just read stuff like this in English, and now I've been pushed harder to read it in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more in Mechtav Meliyahu than there is in Strive for Truth. This is translated and reduced a little bit, and it certainly conveys some deep ideas. But I read a whole article in Hebrew on Hanukkah in Mechtav Meliyahu, and I just so appreciated seeing the extra depth that's there, which I wouldn't have done without the learning that I do with Rabbi Unger and with and Terry Samuel being on my back with the Hebrew. And you know what? And I was thinking, okay, may never get there, but you know what? Keep trying.
Of course.
Don't
of
let
course.
Go. It's of really course. Important. I thought about bringing the article in Hebrew, and I thought, okay, no, I have to do something in English, because we really want to get to content.
Right.
But the truth is, I've come a long way, and so can everybody here. Right, you just have to keep plugging away at it. And if you do one extra sentence a month in your davening in Hebrew, it increases your ability to understand. And then
I can do it in Hebrew, but that doesn't mean that I can translate the words.
That's what I'm saying. Do one sentence a month.
Yeah.
You know, so once you get more fluency in saying it, in reading it, and then you can get more fluency in understanding it. And really, the fluency in reading comes with the understanding, because my reading is, I'm a little dyslexic, and I mix up the letters. But once I know the word
yeah.
then I know what I'm saying. And then it doesn't matter if I don't see the letters right, because I know the word. And I can read it just like I can read an English word, you know, just a beginning letter, ending letter, something in the middle, and you kind of get it.
Yeah.
Which I never knew I did until I started reading in Hebrew. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is really hard. You have to look at all the letters.
And the order in which they appear.
Yeah. Okay. So we want to look at what Rav Dessler has to say here about boldness and the cause of Hanukkah. Okay. So so here it's talking about subconscious. So let's just look at this paragraph on the subconscious, page 152. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter emphasized the power of the subconscious over our lives. We may decide to act in a rational manner, so that may be a decision that we make, but subconscious forces not under our direct control may override our decision. To illustrate the power of the subconscious, Rav Yisrael asks us to imagine a Rav who has an excellent pupil who's very close to him and whom he loves dearly. The Rav also has a son who's not so great, right? Not the smartest, not the nicest. From a rational point of view, the pupil is much closer to him than the son. Yet if a fire breaks out in the yeshiva in the middle of the night, awakening the Rav from a deep sleep, to whom will he run first? To his son. The bond with his son springs from the subconscious, while his attachment to his pupil is based on reason and intellect. And the subconscious will win out over the intellect any day.
Interesting.
Okay, so that's a principle, right? There's a principle. Subconscious wins. Okay, so if that's the case, how are we able to get anywhere, right? If we have a subconscious that's not really under our control, then how are we held to account for what we do, that where our subconscious drives us? And how are we supposed to achieve heights when the subconscious is what's really in control? Right, so these are significant questions that Musser addresses.
I was going to say, just ingraining it, so it becomes part of the subconscious.
Right, so that's
what
it has to be. That's what it has to be. Right.
Right.
To live a full Torah life internally as well as externally, Torah values must penetrate the subconscious. But there seems to be no direct way of influencing the subconscious. There is not, right? As far as I know, we could ask the psychologist in the room.
Right.
Is there a way of directly influencing the subconscious that you are aware of? Okay.
This is rather than action.
Right.
Some people say, put a tape recorder next to your bed at night when you go to sleep.
And you can
hear
it.
Yeah.
So that could help you. That could help you hear it. But let's say influencing, rather than accessing and hearing it, you want to influence it directly. So, so that's the question. How can you get to that?
So when you, I'm sorry, when you brought up Musar, the idea is to train yourself to keep your subconscious or your instinctive drives under control, or
well, to train them. So I think I said this example, but I can't remember if it was in this class or another a week or two ago. So when we were in the NICU, right? So before Rivka died, another baby in the NICU died. Right,
yeah.
So we talked about that, right?
About that
right.
Last
so
week.
That father went ballistic,
yeah.
And they had to call security to hold him down. He was creating damage in the NICU, right? So
right.
His subconscious took over. He was not choosing how to behave there.
He lost it.
He lost it. But the channels that he had built in himself, you are not in charge of your subconscious and how it affects you in the moment, but you are in charge of how you could influence your subconscious over the years of choices that you make, right? So that Yeshua's reaction was very different when his daughter passed away, right? Because the subconscious takes over there too, right? So the question is, how do I train myself? How could I access deeper levels of myself so that when my subconscious is the one in control, it behaves the way I want it to? Right. So I'll give you a for instance that we do every day when we say the Shema, and we say Shema Yisrael, Shema Elkeinu, Shema Echad. Right. So then we say, well, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, with all your soul. When you say that word, you're supposed to think to yourself, I'm willing to give up my life to sanctify God's name. Or as Rabbi Feldheim expressed it, in an easier way to swallow the thought is, I daven that I should choose the right response should I ever be tested and required to give up my name for the sake of God. So even if you're not ready to say, I will, I hope I will. But in that,
right.
When you say that word every day, you're supposed to be training yourself. I am ready. I'm ready. I could do it. Right? So, but that's part of affecting your subconscious. And according to Musser principles, right, is every day have the thought. And hopefully it's going to get deeper and deeper and deeper inside so that in the moment when you're not in choice, you're not. When somebody comes to you and says whatever, you're not in choice then. You hope that you have developed yourself to the place where you do the right thing.
But just going back to this paragraph here, what I guess I'm trying to say is that subconscious is not necessarily something that you need to fight or control, because who would say that he's not supposed to rush?
Of course he is. In that case, that's the right response.
Mm-hmm.
But here, that's just a proof. He's just bringing this example, not as a right or wrong response, but that the subconscious is in control.
But then we can expand So it's not necessarily a bad thing to follow your subconscious or your instincts.
Well, it depends on what your instincts are.
Right.
That's one reason why you train them.
Right.
So that when the time comes,
sometimes,
you just do it.
You know, in a situation, you know that maybe intellectually you're supposed to do a certain thing, but your gut tells you that's wrong, maybe.
Or right.
Or right.
You know, I mean,
but
so
how do you
what right.
do you do?
Right, okay, so that's a different
question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a question I'd ask, because the example that you did about the fire, you know, that's a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a situation in which there is no time to think.
Right.
Okay? So then you go into kind of instinctual mode. And I'm thinking that, for example, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal once about what do frequent flyers do, business people and so on. They encourage them to practice knowing where the exit gates are and how to get out of the airplane so that if there is a crisis, you go into, you know.
Right. When your subconscious takes over, you've trained it.
So that's if there's a crisis, okay? On the other hand, I deal with the subconscious all the time. Every single day with everybody that I work with. And what we do is we make it verbal, you know, you express it, you put it into words. And gradually, over time, what happens is you do change the subconscious. You do understand how your subconscious works, and you can modify it. But this is talking about crisis.
Right.
That's true.
So this crisis situation is telling us that the subconscious takes over.
Yes.
But therapy and Musser tell us that the subconscious can be controlled and directed so that when it takes over in the direction that we want it to go. That's the point here. That's what Rav Dessler is teaching. That the subconscious is there and runs the show when our intellect is cut off, right? And even when our intellect is in place, even if it's not a crisis, it still has a voice that we might not be hearing, but it's still directing things, right? So what we want to do is intellectually consider, how do I want my subconscious to run my life? And how can I affect that?
It's like CPR.
Uh-huh,
so
right.
Like those who are in the place to do CPR, they know it. They're going to be the one, and they learn it. They constantly are learning it, so that when they need it,
they do it. They just do it.
It's a subconscious,
right? Right. So that's what we want, and that's what this talks about. Is that this whole article, which you can read on your own if you want, is all about what happened during the Hanukkah battle that brought us to the place that this should actually be set as a holiday, right? That we affected our subconscious, that we were able to affect the collective subconscious of the Jewish people on a soul level, where one soul talks to another soul, where every soul was included in the ultimate tshuva of the Jewish people at this time. So that brings us back to the Kiddush Hashem, is that the tshuva that the Hasmonean family did at the time of Hanukkah was a tshuva of saying, Greek ideas are rejected. Jewish ideas are received and confirmed so deeply that we're willing to give up our lives for this. But not only that, we're willing to fling ourselves at the enemies with basically no prospect of winning at all. It makes no sense. Who are we? How weak are we? We're just going to throw ourselves, in their faces, and they won. So the winning is taking us into the realm of Olam Haba. We can win. That's the point. In the face of impossible odds, if we know there's no other way, all we do is fling ourselves at what looks like impossible odds, but we know that we want to keep that oil burning bright, then the heavenly assistance kicks in. But we have to come to a place where we're pushed against the wall, and there's no other way but for us to succeed. No other way. No other way to go. You can't go backwards facing the Egyptians again. You have to go into the ocean. What? How does that make any sense? And yet, that's the Jewish way, right? When it's impossible, we go forward. And that's what Hanukkah is about. And when it's impossible, that's when we can shine our light. That's when we can kick into overdrive, into the number 8 mode, into beyond nature, into grabbing onto Hashem and saying, we can't do this alone. We're the scrawny, pathetic-looking cows coming out of the river, right? But we could absorb, we could do it, we could do it. Just help us do it. Help us charge forward and take over. We have something that's so strong that it will take over everything in a beautiful way. right? We're not other religions that say we're going to buy the sword. It's not, that's not it. It's by the word. It's by the concept. It's by the enlightenment. It's by what we shine in the world. Eventually, it's going to shine so brightly that the whole world is lit up with that beauty. That's rather shy.
Yes, right.
Okay.
She said to...